Hi everyone, and welcome to the Finance Eve podcast. I'm back home. I'm on spring break after finishing my final exams. And throughout my studying process, whenever I need a little energy and a healthier alternative, my go-to drink is Magic Mind. I usually take one shot a day, helping me feel vibrant and ready to start my school day. With ingredients ranging from lion's mane mushroom and ceremonial grade matcha, my Magic Mind drink tastes sweet and tangy all at the same time, allowing me to get my nutrients in, but also enjoy the drink as well. During my final exam week, I felt a boost in energy and ended up doing really well on my exams. Check out Magic Mind, helping you start your day off right with my code FINANCE20 so you can get 40% off your next subscription order. Now, in this episode of the Finance Z podcast, I am joined by one of the top investment bankers on Wall Street, Steve McLaughlin. Steve is the founder and CEO of FT Partners, one of the premier investment banks in the world and the largest focus on fintech. After graduating with a finance degree from Villanova University, Steve spent his first few years working at GE Capital in their famous financial management program. He then received his MBA from the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, leading him to Goldman Sachs, where he spent 8 years at the firm, becoming the head of the fintech group until his departure in 2002. With his entrepreneurial spirit and love for fintech, Steve started Financial Technology Partners in San Francisco. Steve was named the most influential dealmaker in fintech by the Institutional Investor in 2017 and has continued to close some of the biggest deals in the fintech industry. I am very excited to have him on the show. So without further ado, Steve, welcome and thank you for joining the podcast.
Thanks for having me on, Logan. It's a pleasure to do this. Appreciate you doing it.
Before we kind of dive deeper into just your success at FT Partners, kind of would like to discuss a bit of your early career. So, would love to hear the story behind why you decided to leave Goldman Sachs. What was the vision in starting a fintech-focused investment bank, and what keeps you motivated given this high level of success FT Partners has achieved?
Sure. I mean, the earliest possible days, I mean, I think people tend to, sometimes forget. Like, I was only 32 years old when I conceived the idea of leaving Goldman Sachs and doing this. So I didn't have a huge career or a massive client list, but I really, really did work incredibly hard for a long time there. And I learned a lot. There was a huge boom and then a bust. And so I learned a massive amount during the boom and a massive amount during the bust. And so the collection of all that experience, allowed me to sort of see the world a little bit differently. I think the world of fintech, first of all, I see it the same now as I did back then. I still think it's a misunderstood sector. It's a sector that it's really truly misunderstood by the big banks, particularly as evidenced by the fact the way they arrange their groups, and for example, you'll see, the world in 10 verticals of fintech, and there's 10 geographies, right? And the way that we look at it. So there's a matrix of 100 different slots. At a big bank, including Goldman, all the verticals are, kind of disaggregated and not sort of run by a unified team. And same thing with the geography. So the people in Hong Kong don't know the people in New York or San Francisco, and the San Francisco people barely know the people in New York. And then you've got people in one floor doing payroll, type companies, and maybe someone else doing the sexier fintech companies in Silicon Valley, and someone else doing the slower growth fintech companies out of New York. And there's a lot of conflict in all of that. So I just saw a huge amount of conflict, a huge amount of disorganization. And I thought, if you could create one firm that was all fintech under one roof, and build it globally, it would be a lot of risk and a lot of time and a lot of hard work and all that. But I thought it would be potentially quite an opportunity. The other thing I would say is just the conflicts that are inherent in working at a big bank or a non-focused boutique are pretty significant. I mean, I saw everyone being really stretched. I saw the work product being quite minimalistic, quite frankly. And I think banking is a very different game at the very, very large company level than it is at sort of the kind of the tech business level and the tech businesses that are sort of in the kind of high growth, no earnings or highly differentiated, area of the world. So, we came at it with sort of 5x the level of effort and energy, that we put into every single deal. And, when you're doing 5, 10x the work of, your peers, when you're taking on assignment, you're going to get to know a company that much better, and you're going to have much, much better outcomes. So I knew we would have a deeper understanding of the businesses, deeper understanding of the market, deeper understanding of, the buyers, and that focus would enable us to get better outcomes. So that was a thesis even before I started the firm, and some of the very early articles you read about the firm before we even really did many deals, talked about these same exact things. So that was the big opportunity I saw. And even though I was kind of a kid, I mean, 32-year-old, bankers, they don't look very old, they don't look very experienced, and I was one of them. And so I had to go prove it from the bottom up. So, the back end of your question is what keeps you motivated. It's like, I just remember how hard it was in the early days. And, it's still hard every day building the business. And we have 200 and something people around the world now covering the, 10 geographies, the way we break it up in 10 horizontals and verticals. So, it's a big firm now. And as you said, the largest vertically focused investment bank in the world, I think. It's just very motivating to work with such incredible people. It's taken 20 plus years to build the team that I really wanted to have. And, I think we've got an amazing team from top to bottom. And, it's those people and the clients that motivate me. It's really not the money anymore, although that's super important to make sure we can run a profitable, vibrant business, but it's more just building something. So I know it's a long answer to your question, but it was an open-ended question.
No, that was a great answer. And I guess going back to kind of your team and just kind of the early years of FT, starting an investment bank, no easy task. As an investment bank, success often relies on the deal makers and their ability to get clients, raise capital, and close deals. You've been able to develop and keep such strong relationships with your clients, allowing you to execute these multi-billion dollar deals. What strengths or difference makers do you believe led to your firm's tremendous success over, as you said, the last 20 years?
There's a few things that I say, even to our team today. It's like focus is super important, right? And hard work is super important, and high quality is super important, and caring about the client is super important. And these sound like kind of obvious things, but not every bank, like I said, is focused. Big ones are very unfocused in a lot of ways. The hard work side of it, yeah, all bankers work hard, but if you're dividing that hard work by too many deals, and you're spending too much time in committees or pitching or doing other things, it's hard to be good, right? And so, I think these core fundamental principles are really critical. And obviously, you can't do any of this stuff without a great team. So I think we decided that we were going to do it right, and we were going to focus on the client, and we were going to try to get good outcomes for clients, right? And so these people are humans. Like when they hire you, they're real people. They're on the cap table. Their lives and their families' lives and all this stuff is tied up in the net value of the business. And if we can help them get a better outcome, they're going to be, really loyal to us long term. So, because and it's a very distinguishing point for FT Partners, that I would say it's very unique, although I think a lot of people say it, not a lot of people stick to it, is we really, really only work on the sell side. For and with entrepreneurs and their shareholders. So, when we're going out to raise capital or sell a business, we're completely loyal to the client, right? We don't really solicit deals from the very large buyers like Intuit or PayPal or Mastercard or Visa or, Google or whoever. So, for us, we can be very loyal to the client. We don't have to sort of, play favors. When I hear stories about people that used to work at big banks and they're representing client X, who may be, a payments company. When they want to go sell that company to a very large payments company, you look at the equation and say, look, they've got this entrepreneur who built maybe a couple billion dollar business, but then Visa, Mastercard are worth $400 or $500 billion, and the big bank is going to make a lot more money from Visa, Mastercard over the next 10 to 20 years than they'll ever see from this client. So why are they going to stretch that hard or push that hard? And a lot of times, what you see is you may have a VP or director running a deal at a big bank. They don't even have MDs running a lot of the deals of this kind of deals we're talking about here. And that poor, VP or director, or even MD, if he wants to go call up the CEO of Amex to sell a company, they've got to go through the relationship manager with Amex, right? At Goldman. And that guy's sort of, or gal's, motivation a lot of times is, well, let's do whatever we can do to protect Amex, not so much this client. And so that's the kind of stuff that you see rampant on the street. And same thing, with financial investors as well. So there's a lot more, I think, conflict in the relationship than people understand. And I think that is something that we don't have. And, because we've been so loyal to founders and our clients over the years, for the last 20 years or plus or minus, we haven't really had to pitch for business. So all of our business comes in via referrals. And this is an incredibly important component of our firm, is that, we really won't pick up the phone too often and call clients because, we're too busy working on execution. So what happens with senior bankers a lot of times is they often spend most of their time out seeking new business, and that becomes the skill set that's most coveted at most banks. At FT Partners, what's most valuable and the people that can pay the most are the people that are executing the transactions, who can create real value for the client, right? If we can sell a company for a top tier valuation and make the client really happy, that's going to be worth way more marketing dollars than you could spend having a bunch of, smart bankers running around calling companies up. So I'd rather just have that client run around do my selling for me than have my team running around the world spending their precious time trying to win business when they should be executing transactions. So, we do make some calls, and there's some companies you really want to get a hold of. But in general, 99% of our business has been inbound referrals, and inbound calls. So that's a way better model than making the phone calls around the street.
Most definitely. And Steve, I want to kind of jump into kind of more of the fintech trends, the fintech companies, and kind of the outlook for M&A markets. So I was just love to get your thoughts. We've seen in the last 2 years M&A deal flow and IPO market for investment banks has slowed down dramatically in comparison to the 2021 peak. In particular, fintech deal activity has declined nearly 70% in those years. However, it seems that the IPO market may be kind of opening up. We saw Reddit IPO and Astor Labs IPO. I was just kind of curious, what is your current outlook for the M&A and IPO markets for fintech companies and for the broader technology industry as a whole?
Yeah, no, good set of questions. I mean, first of all, I think if you look at the last 2 years, every single major investment bank has made massive layoffs, right? And boutiques, by the way. We have not. I'm talking at this at very, very senior ranks. Barclays just announced literally today they're, making hundreds and hundreds of layoffs. Did you see that?
I saw that, yeah.
Yeah. And that's, right on the, brink of bonuses and all this kind of stuff. So, and then of course you saw Credit Suisse go out of business. You saw Greenhill pretty much melt down into nothingness and get sold. A bunch of other banks have been absorbed up, or shrank. So, for us, we've kept the senior team intact. We haven't had any of those kind of like layoff moments for the, for the key people at the firm. And basically, we've kept the team intact. So, we're here, we're ready for the market to rebound, and it is rebounding. So we've been right about keeping the team intact. So, as far as, M&A, IPOs, private capital raising, that's kind of what we do. We do a lot of private capital raising, we do a lot of sell side M&A, and we do IPO advisory, which is a less frequent thing for us. So pretty glad we didn't rely on that. With the IPO market being pretty much shut down, I think it's going to be still shut down between now and the rest of the year. And I say shut down, and of course, there's a few that are going to squeak out, like Reddit and others, and in other geographies, by the way, India, and Asia and other markets. The fintech world is actually booming in some of these markets. So my comments are kind of maybe specific to America at the moment. and maybe Europe. But no, I think this year is going to be the year of selected M&A, selected medium to big size cap raises for us, and the occasional IPO. I think the popular wisdom, I think amongst us and some other very high level senior investment bankers that I spent a lot of time with at other banks, is that the market's going to come more screaming back in 25, right? And the market for deals, I should say. So I think that's something that we're looking forward to. So if you come out of 22 and 23 alive, and you can do pretty well in 24, I think 25 and beyond should be much better years. And part of that's just math, right? There's this enormous amount of really good companies out in the market right now that are private and doing well, and that want to go public. And I think everyone's just being super patient, saying when investors start paying attention to pre-IPO and IPO companies, there would be a flood of them. And unfortunately, when there's a big flood, there's always like too many, and so you have to kind of get in line, and the more high quality ones go first, and then there's sort of a pecking order to that. I do think there's a bit of a cautionary tale as well, and this whole conflict thing I was talking about earlier is that when the big banks go take these companies public, there's typically the same conflict, right? How many big investors got burned during the big IPO craze, where IPOs and SPACs all cratered? Well, you can bet that the next, first 100 IPOs that come out of the gate, once the market comes back, the markets can be pretty skeptical and expect the big banks to price these things much more reasonably. Not just because of the market, but because these big firms feel like there's a you owe me kind of a mentality, and because they got enough losses, so they want some gains back. So there's all that. And look, some of my views here I think are somewhat skewed and somewhat from a view of being around for a long time and being a little skeptical about how the system works, but take it for what you will.
Yeah, no, definitely. And then I guess going back to kind of just these private companies looking to go IPO maybe. Last year we saw Stripe sell $6.5 billion worth of private stock from employees, existing investors to new private equity investors, rather than going public. So in regards to like the IPO market for fintech companies, will it become more attractive, I guess, as you said, next year? Or do you believe fintech companies like Chime, Bolt, Klarna, do you think they'll continue to sell private shares, known as the private IPO, or look for potential financial buyers?
I think the good news is the private markets are going to be easier to tap than the public markets. So I think you'll start to see more, well, not start to see, you'll continue to see more and more private rounds and people really not wanting to go public. Quite frankly, I think the IPO event is, the be all end all for certain people and certain companies, and they really want to get there. But you look at the Stripes and Revoluts and, like you said, Klarna's and others, they really, really are taking their time, and part of that is they want to, and part of that is they have to. I mean, Stripe could have easily gone public during the IPO craze, and so could have Revolut or Klarna or whomever. And so, but as I always say, the public market is sort of the equilibrium of all the buyers and sellers who have very, very, very limited information, whereas the private market is sort of, you get to somewhat pick and choose who you talk to, and you're looking for one or two investors to really believe in the story, and those investors thankfully get lots and lots of deep due diligence and lots of time with management, and can get a lot more information than you would typically get in an IPO or a public company. So those valuations can tend to be a little bit higher. So I think you could easily see many companies wait many, many years before going public, because I think the much talked about benefits of an IPO, pretty much they're still there, but they, I think, have been squashed a lot by the valuations in the market, the vagaries of having your stock price go up and down, like a yo-yo if you're missing your earnings by a little bit. And you saw a public company called Adyen miss their earnings by, a very small amount, but the market was like hyper worried about it, and the stock dropped, a huge, huge percentage. It took them a few months to gain the confidence back, and it was back up again. But you can wake up one day and your company's worth half. So you have a lot less volatility in the private markets, a lot more investors to go to in the private markets, and a lot more disclosure you can give in the private market. So we're kind of zealots for staying private as long as you can, as long as the money is there. And if you need to go public because the private money's, maybe run out, or, you've talked to everybody, or, you really need a currency to go and make acquisitions, or currency to pay your employees, or you really need to get like drip level liquidity out, then sure, being a public company is perfectly fine, and certainly have served many companies like Amazon and Microsoft and Apple and Tesla, quite well, because of course if you get that big, there's just not enough private money to support those companies. So yeah, there's a time and a place for it, but it's usually for much more larger market cap companies. And I think, maybe I'll just shift it to a little bit of a topic that was talked about at a conference that I just hosted in New York, where, the way the world's working right now is the top, 10 stocks, Nvidia, Tesla, Apple, Microsoft, Google, et cetera, Facebook, they're sucking all the growth out of the market. And those stocks are doing quite well. You look below the top 10 or 15 or 20 stocks, the whole market is more or less sagged and flat, and investors view it as sort of, boring. And instead of saying, look, I need to get billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars into the top 20 companies, right? And I can't be, sort of monkeying around with 100 and $200 million IPOs, right? And reading 10-Ks and Qs to put maybe $10 million to work in IPO X, or, secondary Y, or public company Z that has $1 billion or $2 billion market cap and a $250 million float, right? I have to get big dollars in these growth companies. And the growth companies are Nvidia and the big dogs, right? So it's sucking all the attention. And when I say all, it's a bit of a hyperbole, because obviously there's a lot of people investing in the other 10,000 companies. But in terms of where the attention is, it's definitely not on people putting $5 and $10 million checks into IPOs. It's getting $20 billion into Nvidia, and deciding, is that going up or down, right? Or shorting.
Definitely. And for my last question, just going back to kind of like the Mag 7 stocks, artificial intelligence, AI, it's taking the technology and business world by storm. What role do you see kind of AI playing in the fintech space in the future? And are there any trends or companies in fintech that catch your eye, and you believe our listeners should keep a lookout for in the next few years?
I'm not going to name any specific companies, but I think what's interesting is, I think AI, first of all, there's obviously AI has been around for a very long time. I mean, I'm on podcasts in 6, 7, 8 years ago talking about AI at MIT. So AI has been around, and a lot of our clients and lenders and insurance companies and lots of marketing type organizations use AI. If what you're really talking about is more modern LLMs and generative AI, that stuff is super powerful, and we're starting to see short term effects of that, but it's more in the day-to-day operations of a lot of these financial services companies, honing marketing, honing programming and QA and things like that. There's already massive costs coming out of businesses by, moving to more modern ways of scouring the market for advertising spend and engineering dollars. But what we haven't seen is any serious breakout companies that are sort of AI first companies. Maybe a good example of that would be a company called WorldCoin, which is a Sam Altman backed company. We helped them raise, a significant chunk of money, not that long ago, and their whole business is based upon, the emergence of AI, and uses AI and is sort of as a sister company, if you will, to OpenAI. So it's we have played in it quite significantly, but you just have not seen these more generic platforms that are sort of only built for financial services that have really scaled. I could name probably 10 or 15 or 20 companies that got so far to 10 or 20 million of revenue doing something within AI and financial services, but you haven't seen the multi-billion dollar valuations and all this kind of stuff outside of maybe like, the client I mentioned called WorldCoin, Tools for Humanity. But I think long term, what we're really excited about is, AI and generative AI is sort of the key to unlocking value in financial services, because there's, an infinite number of financial products by an infinite number of providers that have infinite amount of complicated terms and conditions. And how's any human being supposed to look at their entire financial life, scan every single product on the face of the planet, and make the right decisions on a moment by moment basis. Most people are, not that educated about, buying financial products. They don't even know what financial products there are. If you have an AI assistant helping you or your advisor make all those kind of decisions, you're most likely over the course of many, many years going to make, dozens of the right decisions versus wrong decisions, or at least enhanced better decisions, and you compound those smarter, better decisions over a 50-year career in retirement, it can make a material difference on the back end. And so I think we're looking forward to the day where, financial services and banking and insurance and lending is much, much, much more open, where the data is much more available. There's open APIs into everything, and you can open and switch accounts and optimize, between accounts quite effectively. And, that can unlock a massive amount of financial leverage for consumers and businesses. So lots and lots of ways to think about it. Great question.
Yeah, perfect. I that is that kind of concludes my questions. Steve, thank you for your time. It was kind of an honor having you on the Finance Z podcast to educate the next generation of finance and business leaders. I appreciate it.
Logan Lynn, the man, the myth, the legend. Thank you, sir.
Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning into this talk with Steve McLaughlin. It means a lot, and we're grateful for your support. If you like this episode, please drop a 5-star review on Apple and Spotify podcasts and subscribe. You can follow us more for updates on Instagram at the Finance Z Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Have a great rest of your day and never stop learning.